God has set up life as a paradox. Out of weakness, we find strength. Out of giving up, we get. Out of not having, we have more. Out of not grasping, we arrive at what's most important and what's most good. And the hard part is we can't make it happen. But the good part is that God does make it happen. He's at work in us, and He's the one that we trust in to change us, to be strong, non-grasping, loving people.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
This program is a sad program, and it's a good program. The reason it's a sad program is it's because it's our very last one. And we've been doing this for a really long time together. We were just thinking, talking before we walked down into our recording room about what a bad job, at least I did in the beginning, how scared I was and how I could hardly talk into the microphone. And boy, the editor had to do so much editing too. I was just thinking about the last program that we broadcast. And I don't think we had many pauses. We didn't ask the technician to turn it off and on. And we were just kind of going through. It's sad because I've really appreciated the opportunity to spend with you, Jack. I just couldn't have imagined a better thing to do with the last 3 years of my life, but to sit under your teaching for all by myself. Actually, the whole listening audience has been here, but I haven't experienced it that way. I've been able to sit and learn from you and listen to you and hear your perspective. And I really do look forward to listening to the tapes again over the years and hear more of what you have to say. So this is a good day in the sense that I'm remembering so much good that's happened and what an honor it is to have been given the opportunity to be sitting here.
Well, you're way too kind. Thank you.
No, I'm not kind at all. It's just true.
Okay. Well, it's been delightful. I can't believe it's been that long. I mean, it just seems like it's zipped by. Just seems like yesterday that we were experimenting and starting and getting this thing off the ground. But it's been very good for me. I've learned a lot, and I've enjoyed getting to know you a whole lot. So, thank you.
I've been really grateful for you to be able to get to know me, because your opinion of how I think and who I am has been very important to me in the last 20 years of my life. And I, as you know, didn't experience you as really having a lot of faith in who I am and what I do. And over the last 3 years, I've experienced you really taking the opportunity to understand what I'm saying and to hear it from a different perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think you've done that. I think you've been a great listener, and you've really given me an opportunity to tell you what I think, what I believe, what I feel, what's important. I think you've validated that I have things to say, and that the ministry that I'm involved in, especially as a counselor, is a valid one, is a good one, and is based on some real bedrock. And I think you're a real wise person. I think you are. There isn't anybody that I more like that kind of validation from, because I see you as somebody who's really looked at the scriptures and trying to understand them and really, really taking it seriously, and who as a result is living your life in a kind way, in a wise way, in a loving way. And what better feedback could I get than from someone like you?
Well, thank you for saying so, and all that's very true. I have very much grown to appreciate and trust and learn from you, and your perspective has been very enlightening to me. So, yeah, it's been a great experience. Thanks.
So here we are at our last program and appreciating each other, and I think before we go on to what the content of today will be about, I think I'd also like to say thanks to the person that I'm calling the technician today, but to Jennifer Manning, who has done just a remarkable job in editing what we've done here. And sometimes there needs to be a whole lot of editing. People don't know this, but I don't have a septum in my nose. And so I have a hard time with sniffles and with voice. And she's really worked hard at bringing out the best in our voices and the best in the content here.
Yeah.
So you surprised me with what we were going to talk about today. And it's actually, every time we've met, we've kind of been surprised about what we were going to talk about. Lots of people say, did you have an outline? Do you guys, like, take notes? Do you read a lot before? And, yeah, I think we read a lot and we think a lot, but we never have an outline. Never. Maybe once. I think once we did, and, man, that was a mess, wasn't it? Remember that?
Yeah, we gave up fast.
Yeah, we couldn't get our bearings. So it's all been extemporaneous. And so today you came and said, you know, what I think I'd like to do is talk about those things that we'd most like to communicate to people as we leave. And you said, what is the one thing I'd like to communicate? And I don't know if I can ever say one thing, Jack. But I think there are several things that we can leave our listening audience with and say, boy, we think these are really important markers that we live by. Mm-hmm. So I'll start with you.
Okay. As it happens, I mean, this is really, I think, providential and crucial, because I had been thinking, you know, that might be a very interesting place to end, is just, what can I boil down to, what's the one most important thing that I think I'd like to leave with the audience? And I'm not sure that I had resolved it, but this morning I was in a Bible study, a weekly Bible study that I have with a bunch of men from our church, and we're going over a passage that it's always, I've always stumbled over it a little bit, because I've never really quite kind of got what I think Jesus is saying in Matthew 5. And the men this morning, as we talked about it, really helped me, I think, see what I think Jesus is really saying. And I think I've seen it for the first time. And it just struck me as I came to see, what Jesus was saying. That's kind of it. I mean, that's what I would want to leave people with, because it's probably the most crucial thing that I think I have come to see and has begun to shape my life, that I see so often lacking in other people. It makes the difference between a faith that is stable and a faith that is not so stable. And so I think I'd like to look at that passage briefly.
I'm excited. Let's go for it.
Okay. It's in the Upper Room Discourse. We're all familiar with the passage, I'm sure. It's a very familiar passage. He starts off with, you have heard that the ancients were told, you shall not commit murder, and whoever commits murder shall be liable to the court, and so on. Then he goes on to the next one, and it's a bunch of, you heard said, but I say to you, you've heard said, but I say to you. The second one is adultery. And he says, you have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. That part we could talk about, but that's not the part that I stumbled over. I mean, that was pretty straightforward. I understood all too well what he was saying there. But he goes on from there and he says, if your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. I've always stumbled over that, because it's clearly he doesn't mean that literally. Because if I'm plagued by lust, for example, plucking out my right eye isn't going to help me any. That's not going to help me control that and transcend that sin, that evil in me. Cutting off my right hand is not going to do that. So obviously he doesn't mean it literally. Is it a metaphor for just, you've got to take this really seriously, Jack? Avoiding sin is an important thing to do in your life, and take drastic measures if need be to deal with sin in your life. Could be. So it could be that the kind of thing he has in mind is, for example, as exemplified by Joseph, when Potiphar's wife was seeking to kind of seduce him, and he fled, he got out of there because he didn't want to transgress, he didn't want to have anything to do with evil. Is that all Jesus is saying? Is run? You know, don't get yourself out of the situation and take drastic measures to get out of the situation because this is really serious stuff. Could be. You know, I thought maybe something like that is what he's talking about. But if so, why this metaphor? You know, why pluck your right eye out and cut your right hand off if need be? Because it's better to leave this world dismembered, you know, without a whole body than to have your whole body cast into hell. That seems like such a extreme and kind of misfit metaphor for just flee from evil. So I never could quite figure out, you know, what are you thinking, Jesus? Why this metaphor? What exactly is your point?
And I think underneath your thoughts is, man, there must be something more.
Yeah, exactly.
I can't quite get this.
Exactly. And I've never really been able to put my finger on it. But as the discussion went on this morning, one of the guys made the suggestion that maybe the eye and the hand are describing, you know, my contact with the world, or, you know, it's through the eyes that I receive information, and I know things, and I see things that are appealing or not appealing. It's a primary sense, as is the sense of touch that the hand might represent. Maybe the hand and the eye just represent sense experience itself. And what would it mean to pluck out the eye and to cut off the hand then? Well, we have a tendency, and this is very apt in the context of adultery and lust, which is the context in which this is set. We have a tendency to become slaves of our sense experience, a slave of the delights of our senses. And we would call that sensuality. I mean, I think the way I use the word sensuality is an immoral condition. It's not just, sensuality is not just the fact that I have senses and sense experience, but the fact that I'm given over to it, that I indulge it, that I am a slave of it, that it's so important to me that I will not sacrifice it. I will not forsake it. So what occurred to me is that the plucking out of the eye and the cutting off the hand is a kind of graphic, dramatic metaphor for a repudiation of sensuality.
Don't be driven by your passions.
Exactly. And be willing to sacrifice, be willing to give up, be willing to go without sensual delight if need be, in order to pursue what's right and what's good, what's obedient, in order to not transgress righteousness. Be willing to give up sensual delight if need be. And that all of a sudden makes a lot of sense to me, because that's exactly the problem. I mean, that's exactly a decision that is so difficult for us to make, and so many of us don't make that decision and can't bring ourselves to make that decision. We don't want to go without in this life. We have one of the messages of the world around us, a message I've heard my whole life, is, you know, we don't want to lose out. We don't want to miss out. Life has so much to offer. There's so many wonderful things out there, so many delights, so many pleasures, so many joys. And why wouldn't I want it all? Back in the 60s, the whole concept of self-realization and self-fulfillment, filling your life up with everything that life had to offer, was a really important cultural virtue that you and I grew up with, or we were surrounded by that kind of message. And Jesus is saying exactly the opposite of that. He's saying, you know, what you're all about, your existence, is about an eternity of life with a capital L. The most important thing you can do is to make sure that you're qualified for that life with a capital L. And if that means going without in this life, then by all means, go without in this life. Repudiate, cut yourself off from, deny yourself some of the things that this world has to offer, the sensual delights that this world has to offer. Do without them if need be, if that's what you have to do in order to pursue what's right and obedient and good and righteous and so on. And I think that's probably, you know, when I think about it, when that struck me as, you know, that's the message that I think our world in particular, our culture, our Christian culture needs to hear. Because we live in a very sensual culture, a culture that is given over to sensuality. We live in a very, very addicted to sensuality culture on the one hand, and the church itself is so compromised in that respect. We are so worldly, so given over to a worldliness that that wants my Christianity to come and heighten my sensual experience, heighten my enjoyment of this life, heighten the gusto of this life, and that's its message. I mean, that's what it's all about. Denial is not something that we think in terms of very much, self-denial.
So, Jack, how do you see it taking form in your life? You said you look around and you don't see it happening in many lives, and yet I think you're saying I'm thankful that it's kind of seeping its way into my life. How do you see it?
Well, I hope that it is. At least I recognize the danger. I'm sure there are many ways in which it hasn't taken hold of my life, and that's what I need to work on. But
perhaps we often look at what's most dangerous to us.
Right, right.
Did you understand what I meant by that?
That we often look at what's most dangerous to us?
Yeah, we're caught. You're caught by the scripture because you can see that it could be a weakness
right.
in your own life.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's so easy to begin to, I mean, where I see the temptation is when I begin to feel sorry for myself because my life, my teaching ministry, my job that I think I am doing out of obedience to God, doesn't leave me time for a lot of things that when I was younger were pretty important to me. I mean, I hardly ever sit down. I mean, I used to sit down and play the guitar all the time. I have not touched my guitar in 15 years, probably. And mostly because I don't have time. I mean, to play it all the time is time consuming. And as much as I enjoyed it, I've got other things that have crowded in and they are a higher priority. I used to listen to music a lot. I hardly ever listen to music. And if I do, it's just background. I mean, I used to stick the earphones on and just escape in a good album, or that dates me, doesn't it? what today would be a good CD. You know, I used to just escape in the music and the delight of really nice sounds and interesting lyrics.
So, Jack, are you saying that playing your guitar or listening to music is a bad thing or a wrong thing?
No, I'm not. But what would be wrong is if I, and what I'm tempted to, is to start feeling sorry for myself that I am now losing what I once had. Now, I must say, the older I get, the less interesting those things are to me, and which is surprising. I mean, it's kind of strange because music in particular was very important to me when I was younger, very, very important to me. Why is it not so important to me any longer? Well, it's just a sensual delight. That's all it is in the end. There was some good instruction that can happen through music as well, but mostly what attracted me to it was the delight to my senses. Music just really was fun, was a pleasure to me, and still is, obviously. But it's not important to me that I have it any longer. But it's important enough that I can begin to feel sorry for myself that my life has gone in a direction that this thing that was so important to me has been crowded out. And then it becomes a temptation. You're going to feel sorry for yourself, Jack? Are you going to start pouting before God and insist that you have your youth back and get to enjoy what you used to enjoy? Or can you be content to be obedient?
But Jack, aren't there situations where sensual experiences can indeed be good things for us? Or are they always bad?
None of them are ever inherently bad. Yes, they are good things. They are gifts from God. They are things that God has created for us to enjoy. The mistake, where it becomes bad, is when I have to have it. I don't just accept it as a kind of serendipitous gift that God gives me that delights me, but I have to have it. I have to have it to be happy. I have to have it to be full. I have to have it to be fulfilled. I won't deny myself of it because it's important enough to me that I'm not going to deny myself of it. Then it becomes evil. Any of them become evil if I become a slave to them.
And that's what Jesus is saying in the Upper Room Discourse. Don't be a slave to what's here in the world today. Look deeper, look further, look to eternity. That's what's really important.
Right.
Look to me, to God.
Right. Acquire a taste for a different kind of delight. That's the other thing that occurred to me this morning. I mean, I guess this is a way of getting at my message. It's a substantive person who will turn their back on a sensual delight for the sake of being loving to another person, for the sake of being obedient, for the sake of practicing self-control, being a virtuous person of integrity. I'm trading one delight for another kind of delight, the delight of being a substantive person, a person of character, a person who's whole, a person with integrity, however you want to describe it. That is a rewarding, fulfilling, delightful thing, but I think it's an acquired taste. And that's the problem, is that sensuality is not an acquired taste. We come into this world automatically finding interesting the delights of the senses. But the delight that comes from being wise and a substantive person is an acquired taste. And that's what we have to recognize, is that discipleship with Jesus is calling me to acquire the taste of finding it delightful to be a person of integrity and depth and substance.
I absolutely agree. And I really recognize that that acquired taste can't be gotten by grabbing it. It can't be gotten just because I prayed a prayer for it. It can't be gotten early in my life. I think for most of us, it comes a little bit later in life. Mm-hmm. When we've tasted a lot of sensual pleasures and when we've lived for those, and when we finally have lived enough in those, that maybe they stink to us. Maybe they're not as beautiful to us because they haven't given us the substantive life that we want. Mm-hmm. Perhaps because they've given us a life that feels rather shallow or certainly unfulfilling. Recently, I was talking to a man who had a number of affairs with women, and that's pretty much what he was addicted to, affairs and pornography. And he really, really was very involved in that, and yet was an elder in the church, and had kind of fooled everybody that he was really heading the direction of God. And when he got found out, what he said to me was, you know what? I don't care that I'm a fool. I want to be a fool. I don't care what I have to give up, because what I delight in with these women is so important to me that I'll give up anything else. It doesn't matter. And what's interesting is that over time, apart from anything I can really identify, though I talked to him many, many times over the last couple of years since he discovered this, and it's interesting that he kept talking to me because I certainly didn't support that position. I just listened to him as he went through the process of making one mistake after another and pursuing what was wrong. But eventually, kind of thinking, you know what, do I want to be this kind of person? And over time, really fluctuating, really not getting it, really actually calling out to God and saying, you know, I don't think I want to be this kind of person, but I really do. I really want these other women. I don't really think I want my wife. I don't think I really want the church. And by some miracle, over time, slowly a progression happened where he finally came rather recently to me and said, you know what? I really had this awful affair with somebody and I knew I shouldn't have had it, but it's the very thing that brought me to understand that I don't want to be that kind of person. Some light turned on in me. I want to be a person that can be respected. I want to be a trustworthy person. And I think that's big. Christine, is that big? And I think it is so real to that person. They said, you know, I don't want to be a fool anymore, and I know I'm going to struggle, but there's something that's gripped my imagination. I want it, and I'm going to go after it. And that is certainly a gift from God. And why does God give that gift to some of us and not to others? And why did he take so long with so many mistakes and so many dead bodies along the way from this person's outright awful sin? Why didn't he do it sooner? And, you know, Jack, I certainly don't have the answer to that. Or for you, why is it that he made you a person that wants this and that's able to look at God and say, you know, that's where my passion is. That's really what I want, and truly believe that. And for a lot of your life, I don't think you are begrudging it. I think the direction that you're going in your life, generally speaking, is what you want. Why does God do that?
It's just his gracious gift that he's giving to some. And why not to everybody? That's, you know, that's the $50 million question.
But on one hand, in the Upper Room Discourse, it sounds, Jack, like he's saying, you can have it. What you do is you just cut out your eye and you cut off your hand and you can grab this. And that's not what he's saying at all.
No, no. Uh-uh. No, in fact, yeah, it would be easy to look at this and say that he's teaching a kind of asceticism, a kind of outward self-denial. But that was one of the things we talked about this morning, is that, but Paul says elsewhere, and I think Jesus says elsewhere, that, and we know from personal experience, that doesn't solve the problem. The difference between what Jesus is saying, I think, and asceticism is removing myself from sensual delight. What Jesus is saying is repudiate it, forsake it. That is, surrounded by it, when you're in the midst of it, if need be, deny it of yourself and go for what's right instead of the delight. That's something that has to happen in my heart, in my will. I have to resolve my will to live my life in accordance with this one delight over here of being a person of character rather than the superficial delight of the senses. That's something I have to decide, and I have to determine and resolve in my own heart.
In a sense, Jack, that's what I resolve in my heart. And what I have to do is just kind of take one step after another to, like this man, when there's a woman in front of me that I'm really attracted to not go toward her. When there's some pornography that I receive in the mail, that I don't look at it. So I'm making choice after choice after choice. Mm-hmm. But it is a work of God where, despite my choices, I may never have the heart that just says, I want to do something good. It might just be that I'm pulling up my bootstraps and trying really hard to do what I think is right. But it really is a gift when God finally kind of almost releases me from having just to hold my breath and you know, do what I should, to have it change over to do what I want. Mm-hmm. And that's God's gift to me.
Yeah, not right. Exactly.
I join him with my choices, but ultimately that's what he gives me. Yeah. And I don't really have a lot of control over that.
No.
I might wait a lifetime for it.
Right. And that's the, you know, what you just said is going to be scandalous to a lot of Christians, because we want it to be our gig. We want it to be in our control, something that we do. But that's an important theme that I hope people have recognized throughout these last few years, our conviction is that what the Bible teaches is that this is God saving me. This is God rescuing me. This is God doing magic inside of me, not me doing something and giving it to God. And that's crucial. I mean, that makes all the difference in the world, how we see our faith. Well, that was mine. I know I've caught you off guard, but anything come to mind? As you've got one shot at all of our listeners over the years, and you have 10
Jack,
or 12 things.
Not, Jack, that's not fair. I don't have one shot. We have hundreds of tapes.
Yeah, that's true.
So this is just the last tape.
The last
you know, one. What I was thinking of actually fits really well into what you're talking about, because I think what you're talking about is dying to ourself. And that's what giving up things of this world is about. It's not grabbing or demanding what I want, but it's having the willingness to suffer and not get what I really desperately desire. I think a great deal of the Christian life has to do with increasing my capacity to suffer. Because a lot of taking and grabbing and having denies the reality that I really can't have everything that I want. I can pretend that I can have everything that I want. I can manipulate for it. Or I can let go and maybe not get what I want, but in exchange, get more for it. It is that willingness to suffer. It's that willingness to take up my cross, I think would be the biblical way of saying it, that we really find abhorrent. One of the best passages that you ever taught, and one of my favorites, is the Beatitudes. And I wonder if we can turn to that. Will you read that passage?
Sure. You know, my Bible here says the Sermon on the Mount. Have we been calling this the Upper Room Discourse?
Yes, we have.
Whoops. This is the Sermon on the Mount.
Okay, great. You know, Jack, I think we make those kind of mistakes all the time.
Well, it's the age. It's our age. It's my age. When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountain. After he sat down, his disciples came to him. He opened his mouth and began to teach them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the," my translation has gentle, but let me add weak, meek. "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those who have been persecuted for the sake of righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
And Jack, the place that I'd like to go back to, and I think the whole Sermon on the Mount is just an incredible passage. And I would encourage people to look up our tapes. I think you did an excellent job. But why does he say, blessed are those who mourn? Teach us one more time.
Well, because if we look at the brokenness of this world, of this reality that we live in, there's the brokenness of the world outside of me, other people, government, society, everything out there is ultimately broken. But then I am broken as well, and that even more importantly, I am broken. And I look at my own brokenness. If I have a heart, you use the word imagination with respect to your example from that man, that something captured his imagination about, I don't want to be that way. If something has captured my imagination and I don't want to be broken, I'm not satisfied with being broken, then I can't help but look at my own life and the reality around me and weep that it's not better than it is. It's not what it could be. It's not what my heart longs for. And I can't, you know, the appropriate response is just to weep.
I think the example that I gave of that man is a person that for so long was unwilling to weep, so long unwilling to mourn, but only grabbing for what he really wanted that kind of made him feel good. And it seems like maturity is the point at which, and many forks in the road and many, many choices that we make, where are we going to grab for what we feel like we must have, or because of something better, are we willing to give that up? And when we give that up, it's not an easy giving up. It requires our taking on a whole lot of loss in our lives. And loss is something that we are kind of allergic to, I think is the word you might use. There's a whole lot of losses. And I think the example that I gave with this man is a really big loss and a really obvious loss. But I think about other losses that come up a whole lot in kind of our everyday lives. And I'll tell you about one that came up recently for me. We're supposed to be teaching at a conference this weekend, and I would really like to see myself as a very good speaker. I would like to be a good speaker. And yet every time I speak, I really get very scared. I am not a good speaker, and I feel like I have a lot to say, but it's really hard for me to, without conversation, come up with the things that are there in me to say. I'm far more comfortable being in a counseling office and kind of sharing as things come up out of people's lives. I've had to kind of realize that. I've felt kind of sick. Actually, I have been physically sick, but kind of more than that, I've kind of felt sick about having to teach. And it's been a loss to tell myself, you know, Christine, this is really why you feel bad, because you're scared about, it isn't just scared of teaching, but what is it about? It's scared of how people will perceive me. It's scared that if I say something, it'll be a hostile audience and they won't agree with me or they will hurt me. It's scared to say, you know what, my life is so full and so big and so crammed full of stuff right now that maybe I don't really even have the time or the energy, or maybe I shouldn't even stand up and teach right now because I need to recognize that I have a limitation. So all those things are losses. All those things are little deaths. All those things are ways that I could avoid what's real and kind of run roughshod over myself and not come to recognize these truths about myself and live in accordance to them. Does that make any sense?
Did you call them little deaths? Is that
right?
Could you elaborate on that? And what
little deaths? A recognition that I would like to see myself as a good speaker and I'm not.
Okay.
A recognition that I would like to not be a person that's afraid of people's perception of me, and I am a person that I wish had a lot more confidence. And confidence in God in my life, and no matter what I say, it really doesn't matter what people think, and I'm not. I'd like to be a person who had managed my time well and who had my life smooth enough that I didn't have to look at the fact that I really don't have the energy to do what I'm called to do this week.
So you call it a death because, let me see if I'm understanding you, you're calling it a death because we have these desires about what we want to be, these images of who we want to be, that we kind of have to just bury and lay to rest because it's not the reality of who I am right now, of who God has made me to be. And it's really becomes a critical choice that I have to make. Do I want what I want to be, or am I going to accept and be content with what God has made me to be? That
who I am.
And it's dying to the dream and embracing the reality.
That's right. That's exactly it. It's dying to the fantasy and it's living with the truth. I think that's also very, very true in not only looking at who I want to be, but perhaps what my history is that has shaped who I am. So, for example, I might want to think that I have a relationship over the last 25 years with my husband that has been really fabulous and that I have really given a lot into his life and that he has given a lot into mine. Certainly in my relationship, that's true with Larry. And yet the reality is I've hurt him a lot and he's hurt me a lot. And there's a whole lot of good stuff that we've done. But if I look at the reality, I can't look at my life and say, man, it's all been a success. That's a fantasy. I have to look. I think what God calls me to do is look at the truth of it, look at the reality of it and be willing to die to, you know, you did well here and you didn't do well there and just have an accurate perspective. I think what's good about that, Jack, is it humbles me. It makes me really not be different than you. And I think that's really mark of a growing maturity in me is I'm not made out of different cloth than anybody else. It lets me be on the same page with just everybody. I've made mistakes. They've made mistakes. And I have only the space to be forgiving of people because we are so much the same.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what the value of death is about. It breeds truth and reality in my life rather than fantasy. It brings me to a place where I have compassion for other people and where true forgiveness is there. It's not a word. It's not a thing I do. It's not a prayer that I pray. But it's come out of a reality of death in my life that has helped me see who you are and who I am. And we're alike. And I think that that's what we need to do for each other is to die enough so that we end up loving each other. Hmm. That's our call.
Now, I mean, what are the things that you're seeing instead? I mean, what that came to mind as something that you really wanted to leave, presumably because you really see a need for it. I mean, that this is key to our health as a Christian culture and so on. I would assume. What do you see happening instead? I mean, how
in my life or in the world?
In the world, in the larger culture. I mean, what kinds of choices are we making where we're not practicing this? We're not dying to ourselves.
Well, I think we're really demanding. We're really trying to take because I want it. Take because I don't want to hurt. Take because I don't want something negative to happen to me. And it happens all the time. In this particular conference, we're talking to singles, and I was thinking that singles really have to struggle a lot with not having, with loneliness. And then I started to think, but you know what? So do marrieds. Married people have to struggle equally as much, maybe in a different way, but where a single may be saying, I don't want to be lonely, and so I'm going to grab a relationship. Either I'll be sexual with somebody in order not to feel alone, in order to feel a sexual connectedness with somebody. Maybe I'll just have a boyfriend or girlfriend, not because I care about them, but because I want somebody around. I might manipulate somebody as a single person by pretending I'm somebody that I'm not in order to lure somebody to me. And all of those ways those are all demands. If you understand the word from that context, they're demands that I'm going to have this because I'm not willing to live with maybe this sense of aloneness that I would die to the reality of, to the desire of really wanting to have a relationship and not die to the wanting it, but die to having what I want. The paradox is out of that, I become a person that draws other people to me. out of my willingness not to grab. But I'm so afraid of not having that as a single person I might grab for. And I certainly don't condemn somebody for that, because I see that, as I said earlier, in my life as a married person. When there is the possibility that I might feel embarrassed by something that my husband does, I might say something that's cutting. Not to be willing just to live with, you know, I think that felt foolish to me, but I'm going to let him be who he is. The thing that has been the most incredibly giving to me is my husband's willingness to not demand of me to be someone different. And I know that I have many times been embarrassing to him or difficult for him or haven't made his life comfortable. And I don't know if there's a bigger gift a person could give than to not demand that we be different, but that we give out of a willingness to die to what's comfortable to us. So in my marriage, I can manipulate all sorts of ways so that I'm not alone, so that I'm looked at well, so that my husband or wife gives me what I want. All of us have to live with a sense of mourning and a sense of death in order to be truly loving people. I'm convinced of that. And that's something that's most difficult for us.
And difficult because it's just not any fun to suffer and to be deprived and to...
And you know what I've really gained, and I know I've said this, is that it always used to look like, why take up your cross? You know, why do what's hard? Why give up mother and sister and brother and everything and follow after God? And that's what I'm talking about here. It's kind of the nuts and bolts of it in our lives. And I see why. I see why, because there's something that's gripped my imagination that you were talking about earlier. I want to be a good person. I want to be a loving person. I really stumble with that, Jack. I really, you know, I'm a mess. But that's the direction I'm going in, and that is what has caught my imagination. That's what I want, and I will struggle, and I will fail. But I'm headed in that direction, and by the grace of God, God who loves me even when I fail, I think I'm making progress.
Yeah.
And it's worth it. It's a good thing. It's out of that death that there is life. And that gives so much meaning to that scripture. You know, out of weakness is strength, because that vulnerability and that openness to death does bring strength. Out of that death comes life. It's a different kind of life than the sensual pleasures that I might have pursued before, but it's a kind of life that has so much more substance than I imagined before. And how did I get to recognizing this? I think what I said to you was something that really came out of this experience is, it's a gift. God gave it to me. I made a lot of choices, but ultimately God gave this to me, and I am so thankful.
Yeah.
I just wish I had it more. And you know, the thing is, I can't have it apart from practicing it and making choices. You know, it's kind of that dual, it's a gift, but I'm making choices all the time. When I come to a choice where, you know, if I blame Larry for something, because then my husband for something, because then I'm off the hook, I need to decide, am I going to do that in order to look good, or am I going to swallow and just say, you know, I'm going to take the responsibility for that, if indeed it was mine, even though I might not look good. And it comes down to choices like this weekend. Is it right for me to teach at this conference, or isn't it? There's a lot of factors involved here for me, and I really don't know. But the process of being willing to die is a really important one.
Yeah.
The ultimate choice that I make, I don't know if it's so important if I make exactly the right choice. The process of making the choice is what's important. It's the swimming to land. It's not necessarily getting there. Do you follow?
In the sense that if we don't arrive here and now in this life, it doesn't mean that it has not been an authentic faith and an authentic dying to myself. Is that what you meant by...
What I mean is, maybe, you know, 2 years from now I can say, oh, you know, I should have made this choice and not that. That really would have been a better one as I look back and see. But that's not really the essential thing. It was being in the process of going through a willingness to take up my cross,
right,
a willingness to die, a willingness to mourn, a willingness not to be succumbed by sensual pleasures, but by a willingness to look at what's really most valuable and what's most important. That process is what's important.
Right. The kind of thing that you're talking about, I've always been struck by how powerfully Paul makes that a similar kind of point by pointing to Jesus as the example. He's the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords. He's the very embodiment of God himself. And he says in Philippians that although he existed in the form of God, he did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. That's the word that you were using earlier.
Grasping, demanding.
Yeah. But he emptied himself, and taking the form of a bondservant, he became obedient even to the point of death, death on the cross. I mean, the ultimate in humiliation. He was the most exalted being in the universe who was willing to undergo the deepest humiliation. Why? Because his Father wanted it and because it was loving toward us. And it wasn't in his immediate best interest at all. It was really kind of a downer of an experience. But he did not regard what was in his best interest so important that he wouldn't die to them, you know, literally die to them, literally give up on them. And then, of course, Paul says, and that's why God highly exalted him above every name. That's really a picture, a snapshot, a paradigm for our own lives, that in the end, that's the life that comes out of death. That's the reward for our allowing ourselves to die and be deprived, is that the promise is that in the end, we're much better off. If we're the people that will die to what we want, we will get more than we want in the final analysis.
We'll change what we want.
And we'll change what we want, yeah.
We'll get what we want, because what we want, our desires have changed.
Right.
There's a verse that I went over with I remember my freshman year in college with my roommate, and we'd say it all the time, delight yourself in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart. And I always thought it meant, oh good, I'm going to get the husband I want, or I'm going to get the grades I want, or something. And it wasn't at all that. It's this that we're talking about today. Delight yourself in the Lord, and he will change the desires of your heart, and he will give them to you big time.
So, you're thinking of sending your kid to college, or do you want to attend yourself? Before making your decision, be sure to ask this question. What is college for? For some, college is the rite of passage from youth to adulthood. For others, it's a stepping stone to a good job. Gutenberg College believes education should be a doorway to a good life. Then you might wisely ask, what is a good life? The Gutenberg College faculty and staff are committed to the conviction that living the good life is rooted in wisdom and character. Admittedly, Gutenberg is not for everyone. But if you are interested in reading and discussing the greatest thinkers, philosophers, poets, and theologians of Western civilization, if you are interested in working personally with your teachers, if you want to open the doorway to a good life, there is not a better education opportunity offered in the Northwest than Gutenberg College. Most members of the Gutenberg faculty also teach at McKenzie Study Center. McKenzie was founded on the belief that a clear understanding of God's Word is more than an intellectual exercise, that the Bible has a radical message for every human being. At McKenzie, you can find classes, seminars, conferences, counseling, tapes and articles, all focused toward knowing and applying God's Word to our everyday experiences. At the conclusion of today's program, I'll tell you how you can contact McKenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College. But now, let's get back to Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber for the conclusion of today's program.
It's been about 3 years ago now that the director of this program approached me and said, hey, Christine, would you like to spend some time talking on the air on a radio program with Jack Crabtree? And, you know, immediately I thought, oh, I'd really love to do that. And immediately thought, oh, man, I'm really intimidated by that, totally intimidated. And as you know, it took us about, oh, gosh, I think 3 months for us just to kind of do practice stuff, for me to even stop being so nervous that I could talk, and for us to kind of figure out really what we wanted this format to be. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yeah, I do. Seems not that long ago.
And no, it really doesn't seem like that long ago. And we went through different formats, and we finally came up with this conversational style. It's very extemporaneous between you and I.
Yeah.
And it's amazing, but now we're coming to the end of the time of the radio program. In fact, when is our last one going to air?
The last weekend of March, and some radio stations maybe April, but that last weekend in March.
You know, Jack, as our time is coming to an end, I just really want to thank you for the honor of having the opportunity to sit in this room and talk to you for a couple of hours every week. I couldn't have chosen anything better to do. It was such a gift to me.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you're way too kind. I have very much appreciated your patience in listening to me and trying to translate me and make me understandable, because I realize that I can go off into never-never land. And I think you have done a wonderful job of bringing us back down to earth and making sure we stay focused on the issues that really ultimately matter, which is what all this stuff is about. I mean, this is not about being smart. It's not about being educated. It's not about knowing enough, knowing a lot, I should say. It's not about impressing people with our Bible knowledge or theology. Ultimately, the end, none of it matters if it doesn't penetrate our lives and change the way we look at our circumstances, we look at our existence, and learn to love God out of it. So I think you have done a tremendous job of bringing the focus back to where it needs to be, and I appreciate that. Thanks.
Thank you. I think that we have ended up being real teachers for each other,
yeah,
and a real good team in terms of learning how to communicate what our hearts beat about.
Yeah.
And sharing that with the people that hear this radio program. And it's heard in about 6 different stations throughout the country. And I think it's a real privilege to have been able to share with all you people. So thank you for listening.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now, on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.